Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
The Global Story is the podcast helping you make sense of the news. Join me, Katya Adler, every weekday as I take a closer look at the stories making the headlines with insights from the BBC's global network of experts. Search for The Global Story wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Thursday the 30th of November, these are our main stories. Talks succeed in securing a seventh hostages for prisoners exchange as two Hamas gunmen behind an attack on a Jerusalem bus stop are shot dead. The latest UN climate summit has opened in Dubai with a call for countries to turn their promises into action, but divisions on how to achieve this. Former adversaries lead tributes to veteran US diplomat Henry Kissinger, who's died aged 100. Also in this podcast, giant pandas at Edinburgh Zoo prepare for a return to China and the end of a Christmas fairy tale.
There was Christmas Eve, babe, in the drunk town.
Shane McGowan, frontman of the Pogues, has died. We start in the Middle East. Just minutes before the Israel-Hamas ceasefire in Gaza was due to expire at 0500 GMT, the announcement came that it was being extended into a seventh day. But there's been violence in Jerusalem, three people killed at a bus stop. Here's the Israeli President, Isaac Herzog.
Two terrorists have attacked innocent civilians waiting for to be picked up to go on their day's work. And we have casualties, we have loss of life.
Hamas said it carried out the attack. Our correspondent Hugo Bashega has been to the scene of the Jerusalem attack, and he told me about that and the extension of the ceasefire.
The area had already been opened up to traffic, to people. It's a busy road, one of the entrances to Jerusalem. The car of the attackers had already been removed and everything was caught on camera. There is CCTV footage which shows the dramatic moment. This car stops by this crowded bus stop and these two attackers get out of the car and shoot at people who were waiting there. And this happened at around 7:30 in the morning, so the morning rush hour. And we now have the information that three people have been killed. Two attackers have also been killed. They were shot dead at the scene. And the authorities here are saying that there are two Palestinian brothers who were living in a neighborhood in East Jerusalem. And Hamas has been saying that they were members of the group. And this is something that has been confirmed by the Israeli security services as well.
So this ceasefire, which has been extended for a seventh day, doesn't apply to Jerusalem then?
No, so we're talking about what's happening in Gaza with this ceasefire. So this is a pausing hostilities in Gaza. And this extension was announced today, just 20 minutes before the ceasefire was set to expire. So again, this is proof of how difficult, how complicated these negotiations have been. And today, the efforts to extend once again this ceasefire continues. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, was in Tel Aviv. He is in Ramallah right now. He's having talks with the Palestinian Authority President, Mahmoud Abbas. And mediators, Egyptian mediators, Qatari mediators, are again trying to reach a deal to not only extend this ceasefire, but also to allow more aid into Gaza, much needed aid into Gaza as this humanitarian crisis continues.
So there'll be another hostages for prisoners exchange later then?
So more hostages are expected to be released later. And I think we are expecting again to see another group of Palestinians being released from Israeli jails. And I think the expectation here is that some sort of announcement could come later today about another possible extension. The Israelis have been saying that they are open to an extension of one day in this pause in hostilities in Gaza if Hamas releases 10 more hostages. So essentially they're saying that Hamas needs to come up with a list of 10 names of people to be released for this ceasefire to continue. I think the Egyptians, the Qataris are pushing for a two-day extension right now. So it will be interesting to see whether they will be able to achieve this further extension of the ceasefire in Gaza.
Hugo Bashega in Jerusalem. Thailand is celebrating the return to Bangkok of 17 of its nationals that were held captive by Hamas for almost 50 days. The extension of the truce between Israel and Hamas that has so far seen 70 Israeli women and children freed has renewed hope for the release of 9 Thai nationals still being held by Hamas. Our correspondent Shaima Khalil was at the airport in Bangkok where there were jubilant scenes, and she's been speaking to some of the families.
I can just tell you that some of them were left speechless. There were tears and there were smiles, and they were just in disbelief because, you know, over the past few days, we've been speaking to family members who told us that they didn't know if their loved ones were alive or dead, and that some of them knew that they were okay only when news footage of the release was on the news and they watched them on TV. Today, 17 of those 23 released hostages touched down on home soil after nearly 2 months in captivity. And you could see how shell-shocked they were. One of them, his nickname is Moo, stepped out, saw his dad outside the airport terminal, ran to him and knelt in front of his dad. And that moment when they were both in tears, hugging each other, and his dad had earlier told us that he just didn't think this moment would happen.
Shaima, there are still a few more Thai nationals in captivity in Gaza that haven't been released yet. Do we know why?
That's right, 9 of them. And I think the reason is that this diplomatic route that Thailand has been going, which has reached them a separate, if parallel, deal to release their nationals, was based on the fact that they were going to be released in groups. They're hoping that the remaining 9 will be released as this truce continues to be extended. You were speaking to Hugo earlier about the extension of the truce. The hope is that with this extension and hopefully the continuation of that, that those 9 will be released. But I think there is a huge sigh of relief in Thailand as those 17 touched down for the first time after their ordeal on the October the 7th.
Shaima Khalil in Bangkok. World leaders are discussing how to tackle climate change at a UN summit that's opened in Dubai. COP28 comes after a year of extreme weather events in which many climate records have been broken. COP28 President Sultan Ahmed Al-Jaber opened the event.
I ask you to adopt a different way of thinking. And I ask you to be flexible. We must ensure that this COP delivers the most ambitious global stocktake possible. So let's work efficiently. Let's agree on the agenda and move to text quickly. Please.
Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath is at the summit.
I think expectations are probably on the slightly higher side than they have been at past events. There's around 100,000 people registered for this particular meeting. That's 4 times the number of people that were registered for the COP26 event in Glasgow a couple of years ago. I think a lot of people here are expecting that they will see significant progress on the potential phase down or phase out of fossil fuels. I think that's the top item on the agenda. Whether that will happen or not, though, of course, is will unfold over the next couple of weeks. But I think we will see a lot of progress on other, what might be termed side deals, on issues like methane, on whether or not there's enough funding for climate damages, loss and damages, it's called here.
Matt, the location's controversial, isn't it? The United Arab Emirates, one of the world's largest exporters of oil and gas.
Yes, indeed. I think there is some controversy around the choice of the UAE as the host this year. I think there's been some questions about whether an oil-producing nation is the right person to try and phase out the use of oil and other fossil fuels. supporters of the UAE say they're the best place. They have large amounts of money, they have goodwill amongst many countries, and those factors may actually be critical when it comes down to the final days, the final hours of negotiations here in trying to get some agreement. But I do agree that it is somewhat ironic that the world is turning to the UAE at this moment to try and lead that phase out from fossil fuels.
And the launch rather overshadowed by those leaked documents seen by the BBC, which appeared to show that Dubai had been using its role as host as an opportunity to actually strike new oil and gas deals.
Yeah, I think the focus here right now is on moving forward towards a bigger deal about the end of fossil fuels. I think that's really where the focus has been. There's been some criticism, as I said, of the United Arab Emirates, but I think, you know, most people here are pragmatic. They don't think there's any likelihood of a change in leadership at this moment in time, and they think that, you know, they've expressed their support for the president and they want to see what will happen in the next couple of weeks as the negotiations really start.
Matt McGrath. Indian actress Dia Mirza has starred in dozens of films over the last 20 years. But away from the Bollywood glamour, she's also a committed climate campaigner. Mirza has just been named one of this year's BBC 100 Women. And she's been speaking to Vandana Vijay about why she's so passionate about climate change.
It's so important to walk the talk. How can I advocate for sustainable living if I don't practice it myself? What right would I have to tell young people that our habits need to change, our consumption patterns, our way of living has to change in order to bring the shift that is required? Plastic became excruciatingly apparent and visible to me when I was doing a show from Gangotri to Gangasagar, where I traveled the river. And I just saw ravines of plastic waste and recognized the fact that we didn't have the infrastructure or the amenities to manage or collect that waste. And it would eventually just either be burnt or end up in the sea. It was then when I decided that I would never drink water out of a plastic bottle again, that I would make sure that I'd never have to use single-use cutlery or a plate or anything outside the house or in the house, that all our celebrations would be absolutely sustainable, that we would make the most responsible choices, whether it was in the food we were serving or how we were serving the food or what kind of decor we were using.
BBC 100 Women this year is focusing on climate change and also shedding a spotlight on women who are working on tackling these issues. What do you think are the biggest climate issues of today?
I think the biggest climate issue is a bunch of egotistical men who refuse to change. There was a time when they were climate deniers, but now the polluters know irrevocably what their choices are doing. They're killing our planet and our people.
Dia Mirza, one of this year's BBC 100 Women. In what's being billed as a momentous landmark for medical science, the UK Biobank project is releasing the full genetic codes of all its 500,000 participants. It's a massive data dump of information that researchers hope will turbocharge the discovery of new diagnostics, treatments and cures, and uniquely is available to scientists worldwide via a protected, anonymised database of the National Health Service in England. Tom Fielden reports.
I want you to sit back in your chair, relax, and then I want you to exhale as hard and as long as you possibly can. That's fantastic. Keep going.
March 2006, and retired truck driver Keith Kingsbury is one of the first volunteers to be put through his paces at the UK Biobank Assessment Centre at Altrincham in Cheshire.
That's fantastic.
The results of Keith's lung capacity test, along with a range of physical measurements and biological samples, information about his lifestyle and, crucially, his anonymised NHS health records, have contributed to one of the most comprehensive and widely used biomedical data sets anywhere in the world.
When UK Biobank was set up, the idea that you could sequence 500,000 people was a fantasy.
And now researchers have gone back to those original samples to sequence the entire genetic code of all 500,000 participants.
It couldn't be done then. It can be done now, and it has been.
The CEO and principal investigator at UK Biobank is Professor Sorori Collins.
What's so special about UK Biobank is a unique combination of scale, depth of information, and duration. And the addition of sequence data, I think, is going to turbocharge the discoveries that come out of UK Biobank.
So we've got the device that was sent out to 100,000 UK Biobank participants.
One of those hoping this massive genetic data drop can turbocharge his discoveries is the Professor of Bioinformatics at Oxford University's Big Data Institute, Aidan Doherty.
Yes, it's not quite as sophisticated as an Apple Watch or a Fitbit, is
correct.
It?
Although for our purposes, more useful.
Professor Doherty is trying to unpick the complex interrelationship between exercise, sleep and disease. And it turns out our genetic makeup is an important factor in why some people are naturally more active or sleep better.
I'm hugely excited about this new release of data because we're really turning up the dial in the microscope. So can we find some new genetic causes of why some people are more active or why some people are sleeping better?
Please breathe in, breathe out, and hold your breath.
The addition of whole genome sequencing has the potential to transform the hunt for new diagnostics, treatments and cures. But the real power behind the UK Biobank comes from the elbow grease many of its 500,000 participants are still bringing to the process 15 years after it was launched.
Well, I'm here for a series of scans which are going to help, I hope, advance medical treatment.
I know it requires flogging down to Reading and spending half a day here, but if it's worth doing, why not do it?
I think, you know, everybody ought to really do what they can. And however young, old you are, it just helps.
Please resume breathing.
Tom Fielden with that report. Visitors to Edinburgh Zoo here in the UK will get their last chance to see the only giant pandas in Britain later today. The pair, called Yang Guan and Tian Tian, arrived in Scotland in 2011. Darren McGarry from Edinburgh Zoo says people from all over the world watch the panda cam set up in the enclosure.
People watch it 24 hours a day. We get phone calls to say, you know, Yang Guan's not moved today. Is he all right? I've not seen the keepers go in and feed him at that time. And as I say, that's great. You know, we've never, ever minded that. We know that pandas are special. I absolutely think there'll be lots of tears for people when they last see them. And I can't guarantee that there won't be tears from some of my keepers when they wave them goodbye at the airport as well.
The pair are due to return to China next month and public access to the pandas will be restricted from Friday as they prepare for the journey, as our Scotland correspondent Shiona McCallum reports.
Crowds lined the streets to see Yang Guan and Tian Tian, also known as Sunshine and Sweetie, arrive in Scotland in December 2011. But now Edinburgh Zoo's star attractions are preparing for their flight home to Chengdu. During their time in the UK, researchers have monitored the bears as part of international efforts to protect the species. But hopes for cubs were dashed when both natural and artificial insemination breeding attempts were unsuccessful. The Royal Zoological Society of Scotland says it feels it's the right time for the animals to return to China.
Shiona McCallum. Coming up in this podcast, we hear how Twitter or X owner Elon Musk tries out a new persuasion technique with advertisers who've left since his takeover.
If somebody's going to try to blackmail me with advertising, blackmail me with money, go yourself.
Tributes have been pouring in for the former US Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who's died at the age of 100. Leading the tributes, former President George W. Bush called Kissinger, who served under Presidents Nixon and Ford, one of the most dependable and distinctive voices on foreign affairs. Nixon's daughters said he was one of America's most skilled diplomats. Japan's Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, said he made significant contributions to promoting peace and stability in Asia, while China called him an old friend. The present US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, paid this tribute to his predecessor.
Secretary Kissinger really set the standard for everyone who followed in this job. I was very privileged to get his counsel many times, including as recently as about a month ago. He was extraordinarily generous with his wisdom, with his advice. Few people were better students of history. Even fewer people did more to shape history than Henry Kissinger.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Kissinger won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1973 for his efforts to end the Vietnam War, but some accuse him of war crimes for his involvement in the U.S. bombing of Cambodia, which killed hundreds of thousands there. Our diplomatic correspondent James Landale looks back at his life.
Henry Kissinger was one of the Cold War's most influential statesmen, the sweep of his life immense. As a child, he fled Nazi Germany with his Jewish family. But he returned to Europe to fight with the US Army, helping to liberate concentration camps. As a young scholar, he made his name, arguing nuclear weapons could be used in conventional wars. He entered government with President Nixon, first as National Security Advisor, then Secretary of State. And his big idea was to try to avoid global conflict by balancing competing powers, with national self-interest trumping human rights or shared values. Its name was Realpolitik.
No nation can make its survival dependent on the goodwill of another state, especially of a state that announces a hostile ideology.
So he led America's re-engagement with communist China and sought détente with the Soviet Union through arms control. His tireless efforts to find peace in the Middle East coined the phrase shuttle diplomacy. And all this brought him global celebrity, something he relished.
I don't stand on protocol. If you'll just call me Excellency, we'll be getting...
He became an unlikely sex symbol and popularized the phrase, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac, his vanity mocked by Monty Python.
Henry Kissinger, oh, I'm missing you. You're the doctor of my dreams.
But this fame became notoriety over his handling of the Vietnam War, especially the bombing of Cambodia, which killed hundreds of thousands, leading some to accuse him of being a war criminal. He was also criticised for supporting anti-communist authoritarian leaders. Most controversially, he backed the coup which brought General Pinochet's brutal junta to power in Chile, something he later defended.
It was at the height of the Cold War, so that the United States could not be totally indifferent to the question of a communist regime in Chile.
Dr. Kissinger was considered so indispensable, he survived the Watergate crisis and was kept on by Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford. But in time, he fell out of favour in Washington, loathed by the left, distrusted by the right, and began a life of lucrative consultancy, his counsel valued as much in the Oval Office as in the commercial boardroom.
James Landale. Winston Lord is the former US ambassador to China, who through much of the 1970s was Kissinger's right-hand man. My colleague Amal Rajan started by asking him how influential Kissinger was.
His influence lasted well beyond his 8 years in government, all the way up to today. So 7 decades is extraordinary lasting impact. In terms of his government service, I think he transformed American policy. He blended the European sense of tragedy and the American immigrant's sense of hope, a dash of realism, a dash of idealism. But more concretely, you have to remember what he inherited and what Nixon inherited. In 1969, we were bogged down in the Vietnam War. We had riots, assassinations of President who resigned, no contact with 1/4 of the world's people, tense nuclear standoff with the Soviets, a tough war in Vietnam, declining influence in the Middle East. And in the succeeding years, all of that was changed. And so that was an incredible transformation. Then through his books, his commentary, his counseling of world and American leaders, he maintained his influence for another several decades. So I think he is one of the most towering American public figures in the last 50 to 75 years.
Let me put to you one of these strands of criticism that his many detractors have given voice to, even in the past few hours, which is that the bombing of, for instance, Cambodia, the support for Pakistan's efforts in East Pakistan, what is now Bangladesh, or if you look at what happened in East Timor, was not only morally debased in their view, because it led to the death of many people who didn't need to die, but it was also ultimately diplomatically unnecessary. It wasn't a necessary part of America's strategy. What would you say to those two criticisms, the moral and the diplomatic criticism?
It's hard in the time we have to go over each of the instances you cite. I'm not going to pretend that he used human rights as his overriding beacon. He had to balance off geopolitical and other objectives with various countries. And sometimes you have to work with unsavory regimes.
And finally, what was he like as a man and as a boss? You worked with him very intimately, very closely through those extraordinary occasions and meetings. What was he like?
Well, he was my foremost mentor. He had more influence on me than anybody outside my family. He was also a tormentor in the sense that he was very demanding. He would drive you nuts and he would stretch my patience and my nerves, but he also stretched my capabilities and stretched my horizons. And so he was a very tough boss, but he was tough on himself than anyone else. And by demanding excellence, he got excellence out of me and many others.
Winston Lord, former U.S. ambassador to China. Let's turn to coverage of another ongoing conflict, the civil war in Sudan. The army and the paramilitary rapid support forces have been fighting each other for control of Sudan since April, displacing more than 6 million people. It's hard to comprehend such a large number of people, so let's focus on just one. His name is Mohamed Fadul, or Mo. He's been in touch with the BBC and has been sharing daily diaries of his life since the start of the war 7 months ago. Victoria Uwankunda has been speaking to him about how he's coping.
Everyday life nowadays is better in terms of the fighting. The fighting is almost, I mean, you can hear gunshots now in the background, but it's not as bad as it used to be before. In terms of food, water, it's there. It's basically mainly local stuff. We don't have any more supermarkets and where you can go and get the normal stuff. But we're here, we're still here, surviving basically.
Surviving. Mo, you just said that it's getting better, but then you mentioned the sound of gunshots that you can hear as we speak. For the global audience who cannot imagine what regular gunfire sounds like, and you're saying it's better. Can you remind our listeners of where you've been for you to be able to say, well, even with these gunshots, it's still better than what we had before?
These are just isolated gunshots here and there. What I really meant was the fighting, the heavy fighting that was going on the first, let's say, 2 or 3 months of this conflict. What you're hearing now is just, like I said, isolated gunshots here and there. Probably somebody who's found a gun somewhere firing bullets in the air, but it's not real fighting going on.
Is it a normal occurrence that people find guns strewn around and they just pick them up?
Oh yes, left over by the army or by the other group. But in Khartoum itself, the only areas that have fighting are the areas where the army is still holding on. But you know, we got used to it now, all the gunshots and what have you.
What are the kids up to every day? What is life like for them?
Well, Faris is 5. And Shihab is just under 2. It's difficult. I mean, we've survived an airstrike on the 12th of October. A house next door was hit directly by a fighter jet. And only God knows how we survived that. But thank God anyway. Not a nice situation to be in, to be honest.
Mo, a resident of Khartoum, Sudan. Elon Musk has warned that his social media platform X, formerly known as Twitter, could go under if an advertising boycott continues. A number of high-profile companies, including Disney, have stopped posting on X after Mr. Musk shared a tweet considered by some to be anti-Semitic. He's since apologised, but in an expletive-laden outburst at an event in New York last night, he accused the companies of blackmail. More from our North America technology reporter, James Clayton.
Even for Elon Musk, this outburst was unexpected. He's in theory trying to woo advertisers back to X, many of whom have pulled their ads from the platform worried about anti-Semitic content. However, using a choice four-letter word, he suggested advertisers that had left X could take their business elsewhere.
You don't want them to advertise?
No.
What do you mean?
If somebody's going to try to blackmail me with advertising, blackmail me with money, go f*** yourself.
He also accepted that if advertisers didn't return, the lack of revenue could kill the business. though he apologised for an earlier post in which he circulated an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, it's hard to see how this fighting talk is going to smooth relations. And without advertising money, the company is in a dire financial position.
James Clayton. The Irish singer-songwriter Shane McGowan has died. He was 65. Last December, he was hospitalised with viral encephalitis and spent several months this year in hospital in intensive care. As the frontman of the Pogues, Shane McGowan introduced his own brand of Irish folk to a new generation in Britain. His wife, Victoria Mary Clark, said, "Shane will always be the light I hold before me and the measure of my dreams and the love of my life." Colin Patterson looks back on his life.
Sad to say, I must be on my way, so buy me a pair of whiskey, cos I'm going far away.
With his stumpy teeth, slurred speech, glass in one hand, cigarette in the other, the Pogues lead singer Shane McGowan became one of Ireland's most famous musical exports. Except he was actually born in Kent and attended London's Westminster School, the alma mater of six prime ministers. Not the most obvious background for one of the music scene's most notorious hellraisers. Punk inspired him to become a musician, but he found success after forming the Pogues and combining a raw folk sound with his poetic lyrics, often documenting the life of Irish immigrants in London.
On a rainy night in Soho.
Shane McGowan was kicked out of the Pogues in 1991. His drinking had reached levels that affected his ability to perform or even turn up. He was replaced by his childhood hero, Joe Strummer of The Clash, before rejoining a decade later for a series of reunion tours.
It was Christmas Eve, babe.
The song for which you'll best be remembered is one which has returned to the top 20 in December every year since 2006. Fairy Tale of New York with Kirsty MacColl was first released in 1987, the result of a bet with Elvis Costello, who said the Pogues couldn't write a Christmas hit, a challenge taken up by Shane McGowan, who was actually born on Christmas Day 1957.
The boys are the NYPD.
Colin Patterson looking back at the life of Shane McGowan. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Ehrlich, and the producer was Tracy Gordon. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today. With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.